Grail. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, those of Melody Cederstrom, who actually supports Radio Liberty, and we support her. She sells gold and silver, and we think she does a great job. We've never had any complaints at all from any of her customers. In fact, everybody we've talked to who's dealt with her has been very, very happy. And certainly, we wanted to talk today about some of the things that are happening. Oil hit almost $20 a barrel today, backed off just a little bit, but it's only going to be a matter of time before it's going over $120, $130, $140, $150 a barrel. And, of course, as the price of gasoline continues going up, and Americans saying, why is this happening? Well, today they announced that the euro, the European currency, had hit an all-time high. Now, isn't that an interesting observation? The euro had hit an all-time high in relationship to what? In relationship to the American dollar. What does that mean? It means the American dollar is falling. Why don't they say the American dollar fell more today than ever before? Well, because they don't want you to understand what's really behind, in large part, of course, the skyrocketing price of oil. And then, of course, we had an election today in Pennsylvania. And there were two Republicans on the ballot. One was John McCain. The other was Ron Paul. When was the last time you heard anybody mention that Ron Paul was on the ballot in Pennsylvania? Not a word of it. Congressman Ron Paul running against Senator John McCain. And, of course, all you heard day after day, week after week, has been about Obama and Clinton and who was going to win in Pennsylvania. But don't mention the fact that Ron Paul, how many votes did he get? I'm sure they're not going to tell you how many votes he got. Because by ignoring his candidacy, he has no candidacy, they control what we think by what they say. And, of course, we see this in so many things going on today. Nobody is going to tell you that the plan is to destroy the value of the American dollar and with that to impoverish the American people. That the major thrust of the people who really run things is to impoverish the middle class, to wipe out the middle class in the United States. Its plan is laid out in the Earth Charter. You can pull it down off the Internet. The Earth Charter, point 10A, equitable distribution of wealth within nations and between nations. But they can't tell you that why our prices are going up so high, why the value of our currency is going down, because you're not supposed to know that we are, of course, heading towards becoming a second-class and perhaps even a third-rate nation here. And it's all being done by the people who control, the people who lead our country, those shadowy forces working behind the scenes to determine the destiny of our nation, indeed the destiny of the world. Well, with that as the background, Melody, how are we doing?
Just great this evening, Dr. Stan. Thank you.
And thank you for calling and letting us know that Ron Paul was on the ballot back there in Pennsylvania, but I guess he hasn't been getting much in the way of coverage, even your local newspapers.
No, not at all. And in fact, there was actually Huckabee was also on the ballot, but I tried to find some information prior to the program, but was unable to find anything or read anything about the results other than Clinton and Obama. So that's the topic of discussion, and you're completely right. They continue to deny that anything is wrong. They continue to feed everyone and mislead everyone and deceive everyone what is happening and what is happening to each and every one of the people in this country. But you know what, Dr. Stan? I speak to people, and I hear them say about the people that are there that they have to vote for, and yet they don't care to listen.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Go right ahead. What were you going to say, Melody, about the people that you talk to and they're not very happy with the people that they have there? Of course, they never want to give us any real good candidates, but go ahead.
But when you do try to tell them of a good candidate like Mr. Paul, they don't want to hear it. You know, he's far out, he's nobody, and what's the point? And that is the true hopelessness that the people have in this country. And it is frustrating, because when you hear people talk like that, it irritates me, and I have a tendency to, we have a tendency to preach in our belief, and we feel strongly about it, but there's so many people like that who are just, I'm not quite sure, they're just, it's not a matter that they don't care, it's, I believe, a sense of hopelessness that they feel.
Well, I think, Chris, the thing we have to do is try to get them to think. And if we can get them to think, and you do that by asking questions like, you know, don't you think we're really paying too much in the way of taxes? Wouldn't you like to pay a lot less taxes? And the only way to pay less taxes is to cut back on what the government's doing. Don't you think we ought to do that? Who's the candidate, of course, advocates cutting back on government and doing away with the Internal Revenue Service that gives the government so much money that they can create all the problems that they create? But, of course, you have to get them to think. And if you could once convince them that the media is controlled, that their reality is, of course, being created for them, that their attention is being focused on all sorts of unimportant issues, and the really important issues are never mentioned by the media. They're certainly never mentioned by the candidates. And certainly there's not a time's worth of difference between McCain and Hillary and Obama as far as the globalism, as far as the dedication to world government. They're all going to keep our troops in the Middle East and continue the war. But you've got to get people to realize, of course, that they never give us an opportunity to vote for anybody who's worthwhile. And, of course, if you could convince them that Ronald Reagan, when he was the governor of the state of California, gave us the biggest tax increase the state had ever seen, and then when he got to Washington, D.C., he gave us the greatest tax increase that the American has ever seen, about 1986, when he increased Social Security taxes, the biggest tax increase we'd ever seen, the biggest deficits we'd ever seen, and that's exactly the opposite from the perception people have. We've got to get them to think, Melody.
Yes, we do. And you know what? Again, we look at our states, we look at our country, and there's so many people that benefit from the government, and they don't want to think, and it's difficult. But I guess this is a battle that we have to do, and we can't stop trying. And so many, I get so many calls about how do I change my wife's mind?
Hold that thought. We'll be right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Melody Cederstrom, and we've just been talking about people's perception. And Melody was saying she gets so many calls from her customers, I guess, or friends who want to know how they can change their wife's mind. What
and
do you
husband.
Tell them about that?
And husband's mind.
Oh, and husband's mind. Okay.
But we also got, I believe we had a call the last time I was on the program. We had a listener call in about his mother. Trying to help them understand what's happening to our currency, and it is so few who truly understand what's going on, and it is difficult to teach and try to make other people want to help them change and to see what's really going on.
Well, Chris, I love that quotation from Alan Greenspan. We've used it many times, but it needs to be repeated again. Lenin, and this is, of course, Alan Greenspan's book, The Age of Turbulence, quoting Lenin and saying that the best way to destroy a nation is to debauch the currency, and not one person in a million will understand what's happening.
Yep.
Not one person in a million. Well, I think we're doing a lot better than that. I think we got a lot of people in America who understand, thanks to the work for DB Kidd and yourself and a lot of the other people, understand that we have a paper money system, and of course it is going to be destroyed. In fact, it's in the process of being destroyed now. And I think, Melody, that as things get worse, people are going to be looking for answers, and that's why you and I and our listeners have to be there to explain to them how we got into the mess we are today.
Absolutely. And we have to realize there was a book once where they change the laws, they write the laws to protect themselves. And the laws that they wrote back in August, back in 1971 when they took us off the gold standard. Several years later, we were able to own once again after so many years. And being able to own gold in 1975 was so that they could preserve their wealth. The law was written and we were able to own gold again so they could preserve their wealth. And we have to remember why they allowed to do that, because they knew what was coming, even 34 years later. And yet we see the price of gasoline rising to $120, and it'll continue to go higher. A dollar continues to go lower. It still takes time for these things to filter through. I received many calls. I can't believe oil is at $120 and gold is still here struggling at $920. Why isn't it higher? Why isn't it over 1,000? It takes time for things to filter through the system, and it takes time for things to react. But when it will react, and of course it's also fighting the manipulations, because they don't want gold to rise. And so these are all the battles, but eventually it will have its legs, it will continue, and there's more and more predictions coming out with gold reaching higher and higher levels, and it should be rightly adjusted inflation-wise over $2,000. So that's where it should be right now, but they will allow it to rise, because you got to remember, they are owning gold. They are preserving their wealth by purchasing gold.
And I think that's absolutely true. In fact, we know from something Dr. Dennis Cuddy told me recently that a lot of American gold was taken to Europe and sold on the market there. And who do you think bought it up? Yeah. Why, the Rockefellers bought it up. And how do we know that? Because one of their employees made the statement publicly that is what had happened shortly before the woman died under strange circumstances. So, and the last thing they want, of course, the American people to understand, that a small group, old families, of course, really control the wealth of our nation. And if you honestly believe Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are the richest people in our country, you've just been reading the New York Times too long, or listening to Rush Limbaugh too long. But the reality is, of course, the Rockefeller family, fabulously wealthy beyond any imagination, with literally trillions of dollars worth of holdings. And, of course, they are very interested in buying gold. They know, of course, that it is the only storehouse for value. And if you'd bought us, a silver coin a gold coin back in, 1920, would have bought you a good suit. And today, a gold coin will buy you, well, at least a good suit made in America. Of course, if you're getting the products out of Thailand, it gets you about 10 suits there. It's amazing. It does. The gold is, of course, always held its value. One of the interesting things, of course, is what's happening to silver. And silver has not gotten up anywhere near as high as many people might have anticipated. We got a call this afternoon from some fellow up in Canada who's trying to buy gold. He lives over in Ontario. He says trying to buy silver. He says he just can't buy silver up there, that there's a real shortage of silver bars. I don't know whether they have those $20, whether they have the 1,000 ounces of silver bags. I guess what's $1,000 of silver in a bag? And do they trade those in Canada, do you know?
I don't know. I have a couple of customers in Canada. It gets more and more difficult to ship things up there, so I kind of stopped. But they can go into their banks. You can purchase, buy the bars from the banks directly. And so perhaps that is, maybe because of the way they distribute their gold and silver bars, could also be a reason why they're making it difficult to obtain. You have to, I believe there are gold dealers and so forth in Canada, but some of my customers, when they bought substantial amounts, they bought it directly from the banks.
All right, now what about, of course, the here in the United States, are the 1,000 ounces, $1,000 worth of silver are those bags still, 1,000 ounces, I guess, are those bags still available?
Well, you have the 90% silver bags that carry a $1,000 face value.
Right.
And in a circulated bag, if you get to the real circulated bags, you're looking about 710 ounces. A nice circulated bag, you're looking about 715, and an uncirculated bag carries about 720. 720 ounces. And, yes, they are readily available. I suspect if someone came in and wanted to buy 100 bags, that might be a little difficult. But, you know, if someone's looking for 3, 4, 5, 10, or 15 bags, they would be readily available.
All right, fine. Anyway, of course, there's been some talk about a silver shortage, but, of course, Melody says that she's not having any difficulty at all getting the bags of silver. But what about silver bars and silver, you know, are those things available, or silver rounds?
Well, it seems like what we've seen is that the items that people don't want to buy, that's readily available. They don't want to buy 100-ounce bars. They don't want to buy, you know, 2-ounce bars or so forth. They wanted to buy the Silver Eagles. And, of course, they wanted to buy the Silver Eagles, and, of course, the Treasury had pulled back on releasing them. They just released them yesterday, the 21st, and so we'll be seeing them back on the market. Now that there was such a strong, because it seems people always want things they can't have. So it seems like it created a little bit of a premium on the Silver Eagles. It's varying between 10 to 15 cents. You know, sometimes I can find them at the same price. So, you know, I shop around to see, you know, always trying to get the best deal on the Silver Eagles. I actually had some older dated Silver Eagles come in last week, which is what happens is when you have this type of a market in the silver, people who are holding silver, they're not selling. So when there was word that there was a silver shortage, people began to hold on to their silver with the hope of silver rising. Therefore, it even dried up the secondary markets. And so that was why there was such a squeeze on the Silver Eagles. Now, if the mint comes out and does it again in a month or a month and a half, then we're going to go through this whole thing again. So I'm not sure where they are for their annual production so far for 2008. I told my customers, you know, if you can buy the 2008s, we can get them for you, get them. Because if they're going to be missing out from month to month, it could be a year where fewer are minted. So, you know, maybe in a year or so you might see a bigger premium on them. I don't know. We'll have to wait to see at the end of the year, but it might be one of those years.
All right, fine. Well, of course, certainly the overall economy doesn't look very good. We find more and more foreclosures here in California and really all across the nation. And with the foreclosures comes the falling in the price of the home. And, of course, if you foreclose on a home, why, certainly when that home is resold many times, of course, you can get it at, you know, with 30 or 40% off the value, the current market value. Of course, this then drives the value of the adjacent homes down, and you begin to see this cascading downward of the value of homes. Now, that would not be in some areas where the price did not gone up. I know we have listeners up around Spokane and the eastern Washington. They didn't have the phenomenal rise in the price of homes up there that we saw here in California or Las Vegas or Miami or San Diego. I mean, and they're having real problems. They've got, you know, they claim whole blocks of new homes that have been put in and nobody to purchase them. How about the housing market back there in Pennsylvania where you live, Melody?
Well, we're beginning to see, I'm not quite sure. I see more homes on the market, but yet I see homes, I've seen a road that I travel frequently, two homes were on the market, and they were sold in a month. So I still see a little bit of building going on, but nothing compared to what we saw, you know, 2 years ago and before. Contractors seem to be complaining about not having jobs, so I don't think it's quite as bad as yet as some areas of the country that you mentioned.
Well, I think, Chris, one of the big problems we're finding is that so many of our large banks, you know, are simply having real problems. Bank of America, I think, reported recently over a 70% cut in their profits of the first quarter of this year. And, of course, Bank of America and Wachovia and Merrill Lynch, I think Merrill Lynch had to write off a couple of $1 billion. I think these others are writing off $4 or $5 billion. They're losing that much, in just 6 months. 3 months. You can't keep operating at a loss, not indefinitely. And this is where many of the banks are doing. Well, Melody, of course, financial institutions are in real trouble. And then, of course, we find that the housing institution, the house construction, house sales are in real trouble. But, you know, one of the most significant things that I've seen is the fact that many of our large chains, the chain stores, are actually either cutting back on the number of stores that they have, or some of them are frankly going into bankruptcy. And of course, this is a real problem because they certainly, you know, this is the sales. Certainly, 75% of our gross domestic product is in product sales. You know, and you begin, of course, closing down the stores, you're going to begin knocking down the gross domestic product.
Absolutely, and I'll tell you what, I'd probably be, personally, I've been thinking about shorting Home Depot because they're building a Home Depot right across from Lowe's and State College, and I'm thinking to myself, how is that store going to be supported with a town that's not growing anymore? We might not have seen the decreases, but how can a small town like State College support two large stores like Home Depot and Lowe's? So my thoughts were, you know, if Home Depot is building here, they're probably doing other building, and I would think that would hurt them in the fairly near future. But you're right. I think also with these homes, I mean, people have to realize with the rising price of gasoline, we have diesel over, what, $4.20, $4.30, and probably in California and other places, it's probably approaching close to $5. And this is putting a big, big dent in homeowners for those who have been able to survive the rising rates and the adjustable rate mortgages. Now they're being hit with these other increased costs. They were interviewing a pizza owner that had one of the presidential people go in there for their campaigning, and he says it's real difficult. Flour is up 300% in the past 6 months. He says, I used to pay $10. Now I'm paying $30. And so people can't afford this inflationary in all our food and commodities that we see. And so they might have been able to save their homes from the adjustable rates and maybe from a loss of job, but with these rising prices, they won't be able to. So we're going to see even further deepening of this credit market.
Well, I think the interesting thing is, of course, that they reported that there was something like 80,000 jobs were lost last month. But, of course, the real figure was close to about 450,000 jobs, according to the Wellington Letter and according to Bob Chapman and other sources. And they simply lie about the number of people losing their jobs. And apparently, this is increasingly a case. And then, of course, when people do get new jobs, they pay less and they have no benefits. And so certainly the people who many times before were making $80,000, $100,000 a year are going to be reduced down to $25,000 or $30,000 a year. And it's pretty hard, especially if you have a family, to get by with that. But more and more people out across America are losing their jobs. And this is what the government doesn't want you to know. They keep filching the figures, because the last thing they want people to know is really how bad things are. And so they keep manipulating the stock market. And the Working Group on Financial Markets, so-called plunge protection team, is manipulating the stock market. And when the terrible earnings for major corporations come in, instead of the stock market falling, it goes up and totally diffuses the impact of the fact that many of our major institutions and many of our financial institutions have had major losses this last quarter. But we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Melody Cedarstrom. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we were just talking about the marked loss of employment and the fact that although the government admits something like 88,000 people lost their jobs last month, 88,000. The real figure, according to the Wellington Letter, was about 450,000. Bob Chapman confirms those figures. And they're not telling us the truth. And in a similar manner, of course, when many of our major financial institutions reported massive write-offs during, this first quarter, what happens? The stock market goes up. goes up 282 points, I think it was last Friday. Why would it go up when all the news is terrible? Why? Very simply, because it's manipulated. And there's something known as the Working Group on Financial Markets. The Working Group on Financial Markets, authorized under the Reagan administration, also known as the Plunge Protection Team. And what they do, of course, is manipulate the market, because then we feel better. We know that, of course, the economy is terrible, that many of our major corporations are losing money, that many of the chain stores, whether it be Zales or Levitt's Furniture or Foot Locker or Bombay, they're either closing down their stores or going into bankruptcy. And yet, of course, we feel good because the market goes up and people do not realize the implications of what's going on. They're playing games with our mind, and until you can understand that, so much of what's going on today really doesn't make sense. Not in the fact, of course, that they're focusing our attention on unimportant things and ignoring the really important things going on in the world today. Our guest is Melody Cederstrom. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And you know, it's really always amazing to me that when, of course, gold and silver drops, and it's an excellent time to buy, most people just don't do it. I mean, they psychologically can't do it in a falling market, and yet, of course, realizing, of course, that the value of the dollar is falling, it's a fiat money, it's going to eventually go to its true worth, and that's zero, and with that, of course, nothing then will have any value at all except gold and silver and precious metals and commodities. Why, of course, Melody was telling me that she's not getting a lot of action. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's pretty much business as usual. We came off a record month to business as usual. I think taxes had a lot to do with it. I think some of these primaries had something to do with it. And, you know, they certainly had a lot of bad weather across the country. And people also are falling into a lot of this information that's being released. In the past, usually, you know, gold or the precious metals would go into the summer doldrums, and they become soft over the summer for them to get wound up again for the fall and early winter. So I think a lot of people are believing that it's going to go down. There's newsletter writers, you know, people get on the internet, they hear people talking about, and even on your mainstream media, that gold is, you know, at its high, it's going to go down, and why would you buy it now? And they believe it. They forget about the true fundamentals that feed gold, that gold is a monetary metal. And as long as we're having these problems, and these problems are not going to be fixed, sure, we can have ups and downs in gold. But we're not going to have the type of pullback that they believe that we're going to have. But they fall into that thinking, well, I'll be able to get gold at 850 or 800. And I just don't think that's going to happen. I believe you might see gold being a little soft around this area, 920, maybe through the month of May, and then I think it's not the same. And each year we continue to get worse. And you know, Dr. Sam, we talked about shortages of silver and whether there were and whether there weren't. Both markets, both gold and silver, are very thin markets. And I do believe that if we had a $50 rise in gold in a day, and maybe we saw a $2 rise in silver, I really don't believe you could get silver. I think it would, or gold, it would be taken and bought up so fast that product would disappear overnight.
Sure.
And that's why, so it is a thin market, and yes, product is readily available today, but a quick move like that, and anything could make it happen, anything could make it move like that very quickly. Product would disappear overnight.
It sort of reminded me, of course, about a week and a half ago, I did an interview with David Sibley, who runs Ready Reserve Food, produces long-term storage food. And I asked him if he was having difficulty getting products, and he said, oh, no, it takes a little while, but we always get them. He called me the next morning to tell me he had been trying to buy a truckload of rice, and, of course, you know, he ordinarily deals in large amounts of food because this is his business. He said it's just not available. It's not available anywhere in the country. And just today, of course, announcing that Costco stores across America are telling people they shouldn't be buying rice. They hold back. At many places, you can only buy one bag. You can't buy more than one bag. And suddenly, the shortage is occurring literally overnight. I think the same things will happen to precious metals. in the very near future. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. I'm getting off while we have Ray from calling from Santa Cruz. He's got a question for you, Melody. Hi, Ray. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. My question was rather a question about within the past several days, unbeknownst to a lot of people, because the media didn't really cover it very well, President Bush was in New Orleans talking about his trade agreement with the with Latin America and Canada, and he was talking about, you know, making laws that would be uniform, you know, throughout the United States and through Canada and Latin America on trade. It was a subject, and apparently it wasn't covered by the media, but I don't know if you knew about it. I wondered if you had heard about that.
Melody?
Well, I saw him today, I believe. He was on one of the financial news. I didn't get a chance to listen. I can only watch so long.
Mm.
But he was pushing for the free trade with Colombia.
Right.
Encouraging Congress to pass that. And of course, he's trying to get other things passed with this, with Mexico and Canada, different bills that he wants to pushed through. So
there's a North American Union now.
The North American Union
changed the subject, changed the name of that, so people will not understand. This is a clever plan. They figure, of course, if people get a lot of things cheaply, they're willing to give up their freedom, and so well, they're going to try to provide us with all sorts of things that are coming into this country at excellent prices. But in the process of doing that, we bring ourselves under international trade agreements, and those trade agreements simply strip the sovereignty from our nation, and suddenly everything in America is under international control.
Right.
That is the plan that's being done all throughout the world, in South America and Africa and Asia. Certainly, this is what the prototype is, the European Union. They just don't want the American people to know what's going on, Ray.
Yeah.
And one day we'll wake up and we'll find that we're no longer a sovereign nation, that our Constitution has no meaning, the right of habeas corpus will be simply of historical interest. And this is because George Bush and the people who surround him, who control him, are globalists. They're dedicated to this idea of a world government, a new world religion, and of course a new world leader under a ruling oligarchy. It's all pretty straightforward. When you see what's happening, everything makes sense.
It's coming true. And I believe also that they've used the elections as a smokescreen, to cover for this kind of things that are happening, now that he's only got about eight or nine months left.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment, Ray.
Yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Melody Cederstrom. We have Ray hanging on the line. But before we go on, Melody, so I don't forget, I want you to go ahead and get your telephone number out, your website, and tell people how they get in touch with you. And then, of course, if anybody would like to talk to Melody here, the number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 464-8295. Go right ahead, Melody.
They can always call me on our 800 number, 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. And our website is discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. And, of course, you can always email us. And our email, discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com. discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com.
All right, we've got Ray calling from Santa Cruz on the line, who actually had called in talking about the move towards the North American Union. And of course, this is a move to do away with the sovereignty of our nation. But of course, they're lying to the public about it. There's been actually efforts on the part of a certain congressman to get a resolution through Congress, and because the administration is bought and paid for, the people who are in some of the committees there, that you know, they won't even allow this legislation to be heard in the committees to determine whether or not it's going to be heard on the floor of the House of Representatives. They do not want representative government. This is a power play by the elitists who want to bring about a world government. And, of course, America is today leading the way. Our military and financial power is being used to bring about this world government. But even more than that, of course, the average American has no idea that the people who run our government, both in the Democrat and Republican Party, have no loyalty to America, but to this globalist dream, the New World Order, the New World Religion, the New World Leader. Ray, do you have anything else you want to say before we let you go?
So very much true. What you're saying, it's so very much true, and it's all unfolding, and it's very frightening. I wanted to make one comment. I believe that Hillary and Obama are controlled by the same people. I believe that they're also puppets of the power elite too. But I can say one thing about Pennsylvania, the primary. I would say that Hillary is going to win because I know firsthand. I grew up in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh. I know that that Pennsylvania is very racist, and I think that Obama is probably going to lose because of that. I think I really know that it's very racist out there, and because I grew up in that atmosphere, and it is a very, very racist place, and I don't think Obama has much of a chance in Pennsylvania.
But I think it's amazing, of course, that this, you know, as many whites have voted for Obama as have.
Yeah.
Because actually, most Americans are not predominantly racist.
But, they
may very well be in certain parts of the country very racist. It's interesting, of course, that they never talk about the fact that, of course, a lot of Obama's base is in the black community. The blacks will vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, certainly the union members will vote for him, and certainly other class groups. They never talk about the fact that the blacks will unite. I bet 90% of the blacks will vote for Obama because he's black.
Yeah.
They ought to be voting for who's the best man.
Yeah.
I don't care whether the man is black, white, or purple. If he's a good person, I'd vote for him. Unfortunately, we don't have any purple people or good people. But anyway, anything else you want to say before we let you go?
Well, they pick the candidates of, you know, and of course they groom them, and they present them to us as, you know, it's as if they came out of nowhere, because the media has such tight control over. How does that work? I mean, they have such tight control over, you know, they control these candidates. They pick these candidates. I'm sure that the media people, the big shots in the media, are really directing this whole thing.
Well, I think, Ray, that they have to understand that the media, the major media in America, is controlled by five mega corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not a lot of the small radio stations, but certainly the major newspapers, major magazines, major publishers, major television, and radio networks are controlled by these five mega corporations. But they interlock, of course, with what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. And they're the ones, of course, who pick the candidates, and then we vote for the candidate of their choice.
Right, choice.
Well, let you go. Bye-bye.
Exactly.
God
bless
you.
Okay, that's all.
And our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And if you have a question for Melody, give us a call. Our guest this evening, Melody Cederstrom. We're talking about what's really going on financially in our country. And, of course, it's really not good. The value of our currency, the value of the American dollar, is being intentionally destroyed as the Federal Reserve System keeps lowering interest rates. They ought to be raising interest rates to stabilize the dollar. Instead, they're lowering them. They're pouring out money. The inflation rates tend to at least 10%, maybe even closer to 12% now. That's the real inflation rate, not the figures the government puts out. And then, of course, the M3 figures, which the government says it's just too complicated to publish. They've been publishing it for years, but they don't want us to know what the future holds, because M3 anticipates the future, and that's running 16 to 17%, and that'll be the rate of inflation within, of course, 6 to 9 months, of course, unless something dramatic happens. What are your take on what's happening as far as inflation and the destruction of the value of the dollar, Melody?
Well, absolutely. We have to remember that inflation is the monetary policy of a government. They know exactly what they're doing, and they know the outcome of what is happening to a currency. And so over a period of time, we have inflationary. You know, it's interesting. I was reading an article where it staged some of the points in which inflation takes us and some of the signs in which you see, and as I mentioned earlier, it takes a long time for inflation to get to its point, but eventually you'll begin to see shortages in world markets for commodities, which we're seeing. You'll begin to see psychology change across the population, and where people will begin to scramble to acquire things other than money, and they'll want to hoard up, they'll want to save, and you know, so these are different signs, and we're beginning to see these signs. Another one of their signs that you said that you would see is countries begin to raise taxes on industries, and some of them, it'll force them to sell their companies, and then the governments will buy it, and we've seen that happen. And then you'll begin to see investors will call their financial managers, and they'll want to sell, and they'll want to know how to stay ahead of inflation. And this article, which was, and they said that we're just basically about 6 months away from this point where people will begin to sell their stocks, and they'll want to preserve their wealth. And what is there? Well, that's gold. And so they'll be searching for a safe haven for quality.
Let me once again quote Alan Greenspan, 1965. You can pull this down off the Internet. Just look up gold and economic freedom, Alan Greenspan, or Alan Greenspan, gold and freedom. But this is what he wrote in an essay titled Gold and Economic Freedom in 1965. In the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect your savings from confiscation through inflation. There is no safe store of value. If there were, the government would have to make its holding illegal, as was done in the case of gold. The financial policy of the welfare state requires that there be no way for the owners of wealth to protect themselves. And ladies and gentlemen, that is the plan. There's no way to protect yourself unless, of course, you listen to what we're suggesting and begin taking defensive action, because they're going to destroy the value of our currency. And, of course, the currency is dropping at a phenomenal level. Remember, today, the euro, the European currency, reached its highest value ever. But, of course, what in comparison with what? In comparison to the dollar. Why didn't they tell us the dollar reached its lowest value? Why, they don't want you to know what's going on. It really should be so obvious to people, Melody, that they're using words to conceal the truth in the American people. Would you agree?
Yes, they are. And I can't remember the term that they use for that, but they are. They're confusing the American people. They're lying to the American people. But, you know, they go to the grocery stores. They begin shopping. They see the rising cost of what they need to do. They see the shortages in rice. And all of these are going to eventually a little light bulb's going to click on, and they'll want to go to preserve their wealth. Many will be too late. Many will lose their wealth. And so it's people should take an active role in their financial planning. And I talk to people who, if their financial planner told them to no matter what they told them to do, they do. And folks, you have you can do it. Do investigation. You can do your own research and make decisions. And it's okay to be wrong in some of the decisions that you make, but at least you control your finances. And that's very important. I recommend that people should carry 30 to 50% of their hard assets in gold. Personally, I think that's a little low, but it should be a minimum. And yet Wall Street and financial planners will tell you to hold 10% or 15%. What is that going to do to preserve your wealth in what we face? And if anybody tells you to hold 15 or 20%, they're wrong. and you should be carrying a lot more than that. And again, as I said, 30 to 50% is probably a minimum of what you should have. I tell my customers if they need to hold stocks, if it's, you know, for whatever reasons, whatever they have in stocks, you should have an equal amount in gold.
Well, now, what would you say to the person who said, look, I want financial stability, I'm going to buy treasury bonds? What's your response to that?
Well, I never understood treasury bonds because I'm not a government person, and treasury bonds to me is debt. And I don't want to have my, I don't want to preserve my wealth through debt. And so they're not, they're only as secure as the governments. And when we look at our governments today and you still look at our declining currencies, you know, the world is based on a, every currency in this world except one or two is a fiat currency. They're having the same problems. They're all going to go down. Sure, they're going up against the dollar, but they're all down against gold. And that's what you have to remember. Gold is still in there. And yet many people think, you know, people have no patience. And we see gold rise from 700, 800, 900, and all of a sudden, you know, they want it to be 1,200. Well, so do I. But and it will get there. We just have to be patient and preserve your wealth through gold and silver. Buy it as the insurance policy. Profits will come. You know, I have people who want to get into gold because they want to make a lot of money. Well, that's okay, but you should get into gold first as the insurance policy that preserves your wealth, just like your auto insurance and your car and your home insurance. That's how you initially should buy gold. Profits will come. You know, they're important, but they're going to come. But you have to understand gold and why you buy it. And that also helps you position yourself in what coins that you need to have in your portfolios. So.
And I think, of course, what Melody says is absolutely right. It's currency insurance. I had asked Melody about buying T-bonds. Well, any form of bonds are certificates of guaranteed confiscation. That was a remark that was made by Ludwig von Mises, who is really the father of the Austrian School of Economics, and certainly the inspiration for so many of our modern-day people, Lou Rockwell, certainly Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul. They all were students of Ludwig von Mises, and he, of course, lived through the great inflationary spirals of Austria and of Germany, and he basically said, you know, if you invest in bonds, bonds are tied to the marks or whatever it would be, corona, Austrian coronas, but they are simply certificates of guaranteed confiscation because you can hold your bonds, but if the value of the currency goes down, you end up with a worthless piece of paper. And that's exactly what is happening today. Right now, of course, people have been buying these treasury indexed bonds, treasury bonds, T-bills, indexed to inflation. But the government lies about the amount of inflation. And they tell us, well, at the most, if it's 4%, well, do you really believe it's 4%? Go to the grocery store. Go to the gas station. Look at the prices. Are you going to believe what the government tells you, or are you going to believe your lying eyes? And I think that that's a good question. Am I going to believe what I'm being told by the controlled media, or am I going to believe what I see at the store? And look at what's happening to the prices of bread. Look what's happening to the prices of milk. Look what's happening to the prices of eggs. Look what's happening to the prices of chicken and so many other things. And then tell me we have a core inflation rate of 2.1% and maybe an inflation rate up to 4%, and you know that they're lying to you. Well, Melody, how are we going to get people to really understand what's going on? It's so much easier to listen to the radio, to watch television, and believe they're telling us the truth. How are we going to get people to understand what a fiat money system is and the history of fiat money systems that down through the ages, going all the way back, of course, to ancient times and ancient Greece and ancient Rome, every fiat money system throughout all history has eventually ended up with collapse?
How are we going to do that?
Well, how are we going to convince people that this is really what's going on?
Well, as we mentioned earlier in the program, it's difficult. You have to get them to want to know. You have to programs, reading material, articles. When you can, you know, subscribe to newsletters like Bob Chapman's, and there's only a handful of websites that I even go to on the internet. Robert Chapman's, even my website, we do put up radio programs that you can listen to. Jim Sinclair's is another good website, and Dr. Stan always gives great recommendations on various books and things in which you can read and share and, you know, make people want to understand. And just like you mentioned, Dr. Stan, ask them questions, make them become involved. You know, what do you buy? You know, look at the prices. I mean, it's no, the most obvious is gasoline. That really hurts people. I've talked to neighbors, and I hear them talking where, you know, they're going to have to start carpooling, the husbands and wives, because they can't afford the gasoline.
Well, before they run out of time, Melody, I want you to give your website and your telephone number out one more time.
Telephone is 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And the website is discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. discountgoldandsilvertrading.net.
All right, fine. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are living in very difficult times. And I will tell you that if you study the history of what's happened in the past, very few people get through this because they don't understand. Probably the best single book on the subject, although it's a large book, it's written by our good friend Ed Griffin. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island. The Creature from Jekyll Island. We probably put out at least 10, sometimes even 20 copies of that book every single week through our ministry. Well, Melody, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program here.
Well, I appreciate it, Dr. Stan. If anyone has any questions, of course, give us a call on our 800 number, 800-375-4188. We'd be more than happy to talk to you about your gold and silver investments. And, of course, we, as I mentioned earlier, we start out at 30 to 50% of your assets in gold and silver. Of that, I recommend 80% gold, 20% silver. And, again, that can fluctuate depending on anyone's investment objective. And so many times they say, why only 20% silver? Folks, if you're looking to preserve your wealth, you want something that's stable. You're looking at a gold that is a monetary metal. Silver can be monetary, but right now it's an industrial metal. And yes, it is, I think it will become very important when gold rises to prices where people have a difficult time purchasing gold at $2,000 and plus dollars. So each has its role, but you have to keep everything into perspective. We do offer gold and silver IRAs that we write. I always recommend to take possession. But if you just want to roll it over, at least get it out of that paper and put it into gold and silver. You can put gold and silver in a self-directed IRA. You do not need to have the proof coins. I know there's a lot of push sometimes for proof coins. You do not need proof coins in your IRA. Just regular gold eagles is fine, or silver. IRAs is a great place to store your silver because you don't get possession of it. So that way you don't have to deal with the weight, the storage problems that you have with silver if you have a large quantity and the shipping. So it does save you, and it's a great place to put silver. So if you'd like to talk about it, just give us a call, and we put together portfolios based on individuals, what's suitable for you, because I do not believe there is a one type of coin that fits all. So.
And, of course, certainly I think that time... Do not put this off. It's sort of like
no.
It was 2 weeks ago. You know, there was no shortage at all of rice. And
right.
Suddenly, tonight, on the radio, on television, they're talking about the rice shortages throughout the world and right here in the United States. And Costco is asking you not to buy more than one bag of rice at a time. The why was very, very simple, because, of course, there's shortages. And believe me, as the shortages develop, more and more people will be buying it. I'm sure we're going to see real shortages of rice, but it's not just rice. Many of our food products, of course, are coming into short demand, and one of these days the same thing's going to happen with gold and silver. It's a very thinly traded market, and when people realize what's happening, they're all going to jump in. Good night, Melody. God bless you.
Good night, Dr. Stan. God bless you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is Melody Cederstrom, and we've been talking about what's happening to the financial system, that there is an intentional effort on the part of the Fed now. They've decided to destroy the dollar. Why would they do that? Well, very, very simple, because they want to try to bail out Wall Street. And so they're a lowering, of course, the interest rates when they should be raising the interest rates to protect the dollar. They should be contracting the money supply. Instead of that, they're expanding the money supply. And you only need to go back and see what Paul Volcker did back in 1979 and 1980. But he saved the dollar from destruction at that time. Today, Bernanke is doing exactly the opposite. Well, if you really want to understand what's going on, let me suggest my talk, The Financial Tsunami, and the syllabus goes with that, because the syllabus has the important information that you need to know about what to do in times like this. And there are three rules for investing: diversify, diversify, diversify. But I think you'll find the talk on financial tsunamis very important. We have a little, and of course it comes both with the talk and then with the syllabus. Then, of course, we have the two little inexpensive pamphlets. One is called The History of Money. The other is called Financial Meltdown. They're compilations of our newsletters, but they give you tremendous insight into what's going on today. Then the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, we recommend to you strongly. The book entitled Fiat Money, Inflation in France, was written over 100 years ago by the dean of Cornell University, Andrew Dickinson White. And then, of course, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton. Small little book, easy to read, but you'll understand, of course, that they create money out of nothing. It's all based upon debt. And if they ever paid off the debt, the whole thing would collapse because there wouldn't be any money left, because we have nothing behind our currency today. However, I do believe the ultimate plan, it was laid out in Foreign Affairs magazine, published by the Council on Foreign Relations, which is our invisible government. Their logo is, well, you can see it down at a bookstore, where they sell Foreign Affairs. It's a man riding on a white horse. I wonder what that signifies. Well, I believe the four horsemen of the apocalypse are mounted and are currently riding across the world, of course, creating all the terrible, terrible problems we face. And I believe that the fourth horseman, the rider of the pale horse, will soon be upon us. So understand, go get Revelation 6:8 and read it, and then begin making your preparations accordingly. How do we put this into perspective? Well, there really are other forces out there. There is an X-Force, certainly James Bond. I mean, Ian Fleming, who wrote the James Bond novels, worked for British intelligence during the Second World War. He understood that there was another force out there. Even Maxwell Smart of Get Smart talked about this other force. What is that other force? Well, of course, many people say that's the Council on Foreign Relations. But what people don't understand is the Council on Foreign Relations is founded in the occult, as is the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, the Club of Rome, the Masons, certainly the Rosicrucians, the Theosophists, all of these organizations. They all have websites, and they're not going to tell you that the Council on Foreign Relations is a front for a secret society created back in 1891 by Cecil Rhodes, who is deeply involved in the occult. But, of course, you're not supposed to know that. Let me suggest that you certainly get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. It will introduce you to this concept. That's the Brotherhood of Darkness. And that you get our three pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. The three pamphlets based upon my writings and the writings of Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And then, of course, Forbidden Secret, which is a DVD, and there's a syllabus that goes with that. Planned Police State. That's a DVD, and there's a syllabus that comes with that. And then, of course, Iraq, the Untold Story, and there's a syllabus that comes with that. The Hidden Agenda. And what is the hidden agenda? Why, it's, of course, the fact that they intend to destroy the lives and the health of our children and of us as well. And that's the story of water fluoridation. Why, that couldn't be true. Why, of course, it must be good because the doctors and the dentists report it. They just don't know. I number 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and of course, hopefully, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of David Berlinski, who's written a fascinating book called The Devil's Delusion, Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions. And, of course, Mr. Berlinski identifies himself as a secular Jew. And yet, of course, he's writing a fascinating book in defense of the, or at least in opposition to the scientists who claim that there is no God. And, of course, they claim that science has proven there's no God. And Mr. Berlinski, although he is not in any way a religious Jew, certainly challenges many of their suppositions, and he does a magnificent job. Now, you should know a little bit about Mr. Berlinski. He's basically a philosopher, and he teaches mathematics, and he actually lives in Paris, and he's just here for a short time. In fact, you're going to be going home very, very shortly, aren't you?
Tomorrow afternoon.
Well, I appreciate so much your taking time that's late back there where he is, but he's kind enough to be on with us today talking about the devil's delusion, atheism, and its scientific pretensions. And why don't you just tell us what motivated you to write a book of this sort?
Well, I think any writer who honestly answers that question has got to put personal vanity at the very head of the list. I'm really no exception. You know, anybody who writes wants to see his name in print. But beyond that, which is, I think it's a common feature of everybody who writes, I have to confess to a certain measure of irritability when I read Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, and a whole crew of other people who are part of that bandwagon right now, trumpets blaring and the kettle drums booming. And I felt myself suffused with a mounting sense of indignation, chiefly because I thought that what this movement represents really deep down is a profound abuse of the magnificent cathedral of scientific thought. And that, I thought, needed to be confronted and rebutted. It sounds a little pretentious. I hear it in my own voice, but I think that's an honest assessment.
Well, Chris, you know, as I read your book, and you point out the fact that whether, of course, if religion is true or not, if you don't have it, you have no moral values. In fact, at one point, you even quoted one of these people who's opposed to, who is writing about stem cells. He wants, of course, to do stem cell research, fetal stem cell research, and he talks that it is morally indefensible to oppose, fetal stem cell research. Well, if there's no God, there's no morality. Certainly, morality is something we sort of make up on our own. Each man has his own morality. How can he accuse other people of being immoral for opposing something on a religious basis?
It's absolutely impossible. It's a point I developed with great pleasure in the book, because it is not only an important point, but in some respects it's an obvious point. I mean, the author you're citing is Sam Harris, and he is tremendously indignant that anyone could think to contravene a doctrine he's prepared to endorse, no matter the doctrine. And yet, when it comes to the defense of his doctrine, the claim that opposition that's based on religion is somehow unintelligible or irrational, he never tells us why. He never gives the slightest indication that there's an argument behind these claims.
Well, of course, if you look at, of course, stem cell research, you find out that fetal stem cell research doesn't work at all, because people, they get all sorts of immunity to it, and whereas, of course, the adult stem cell research is doing such wonderful things that maybe the religious objection to a fetal stem cell research had another purpose behind it, and that was to stop, certainly experiment on something that wasn't going to work.
Well, maybe it's even simpler than that. Maybe it was designed to protect the intrinsic dignity of human life.
Well,
How about that?
I think you're absolutely right.
What is irrational about that?
Nothing at all. In fact, I agree. Basically, I agree with your basic precepts.
But isn't it odd that we both find it embarrassing to say something obvious, as if we're being forced by medical necessity to utter an obscenity? When was the last time anyone has uttered those words, the intrinsic dignity of human life, and really meant them? There's something that's absent from the discussion of that phrase is made suspect.
In fact, at one point you made that was really very interesting to me. The people, of course, you're talking about, of course, I think it was Christopher Hitchens, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was just talking about, of course, one of the big problems with religion. It kept people from enjoying their sex. And
imagine that.
It was really wonderful, and yet we have to look and see what's happened.
Surely it's the opposite of the problem.
And it's created, you know, we have something like 60 million people in America with a sexually transmitted viral disease that's independent of all the other sexually transmitted diseases.
But here's the interesting question. Every single religious tradition since the dawn of man has found it necessary to introduce certain restrictions on sexual nature. This is not only the religious tradition. Every significant thinker has recognized that sexual desire is an immensely powerful, potentially destructive force. Of course it needs to be regulated. Of course we can't live in a society in which sexual desire is given complete freedom, free from any form of injunction and prohibition. Why is it necessary in the year 2008 to remark upon this? It's an obvious fact. And yet the objection to religious doctrine based on the claim that somehow or other it impedes the free enjoyment of sexual life is repeated again and again and again. It's not just Christopher Hitchens. Richard Dawkins says the same thing. His first commandment, have a great time.
Well, of course, sometimes it comes at a terrible, terrible price. And, of course, whether it's disease or psychologically, I mean...
Let's be honest, it always comes at a price. It always comes at a price.
Right. And, you know, really how tragic it is, of course, that all great religions certainly put curbs on sexual appetite.
And how?
And whether you agree with them or not, I happen to be an evangelical Christian, I tend to agree with them, but whether you agree with them or not, I mean, the point is if you do not have some sort of restraint, a moral restraint, you end up with social anarchy.
Of course you do. And you know, it's not just the insight of the religious tradition, it is a universal human insight. You look at Freud, for example, hardly a defender of a religious tradition, contemptuous of all religious life. But what is the great message that Freud argues? That civilization is fragile, it needs to be protected, and it is based on renunciation. This is Freud talking. Seems to me an immensely sensible message that each one of us is forced to learn in his or her own life.
Amen to that. We'll be back here in just a moment with David Berlinski. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is David Berlinski. We're talking about his book, The Devil's Delusion. That's The Devil's Delusion. I think it's basically a very, very apropos title, because, of course, I believe, and I happen to believe in the devil. But be that as it may, certainly what we're seeing is the total breakdown of our society in the name of science. And, of course, as you point out so well in your book, I mean, these people are misusing science. In other words, science cannot prove there is a God, but science cannot prove there is not a God, and yet they pervert science to do that.
If I could interject, I'm sorry for interrupting you, but you know, if you rephrase that declaration, I think it's completely accurate as a characterization of their position. Instead of talking about science, talk about beekeeping, or bookkeeping for that matter. You realize just how inappropriate and ludicrous these kinds of claims really are. I mean, would we seriously entertain a speculation that bookkeeping shows there is no God? Well, no, we wouldn't. But if bookkeeping doesn't show that, why would quantum physics be in a better position to establish precisely the same sort of claim?
And so what you're really pointing out is these people hide behind science to justify their basic bias.
Of course they do. I mean, again, I hate to sound like a broken record, but that point I think is an obvious point. It's misuse of the glorious tradition of the scientific establishment, which is a glorious tradition. I'm the first one to cherish and uphold it. But it's a glorious tradition with respect to the questions that it poses and the answers it provides. If I want to know something about the elementary particles, I'll look at the standard model of particle physics and I will be enlightened. If I want to know something about the ultimate nature of reality, the purpose of the universe, the presence of love in the cosmos, or whether there is or isn't a God, I'm not going to look at the standard model of particle physics.
And these men, of course, are really very, very prominent. Their fields have, in many respects, actually, to my way of thinking, have actually discredited science. And
that's the trouble. They are very prominent. I mean, somebody like Steven Weinberg, for example, is clearly a great scientist. He just doesn't know what he's talking about when he passes the boundaries of particle physics or relativity. He has the same standing as anyone else.
You make the point, of course, that they make the point that, you know, if there is no God, then anything is possible.
Do we need to, after the 20th century has been concluded and remains a living horror in the memory, do we need to be reminded of that point?
Well, I think
everyone in the 19th century said that, and they were all right. Perhaps we might learn from that.
And, of course, you use that idea, if there is no God, anything is possible. And, of course, with science, I've forgotten exactly how you put that, but science says that there is no God, and so, according to science, that everything is permissible.
I think that's exactly right. If there's no God, everything is permissible. If science is true, then there is no God. If science is true, then everything is permissible. That is a very frequently heard argument, very frequently heard. It seems very plausible to a great many people. And, of course, it's an argument that, in its consequences, is absolutely appalling. We know that. I mean, we don't have to cast around for very elaborate metaphysical explanation. We know that a society that says to itself, everything is permissible, will do dreadful things.
And, of course, you use as an example of that the Nazis, and, of course, their idea that they... In fact, I think it was Rudolf Hess who had actually said that, you know, Nazism is simply applied science. And, of course...
they believed that.
They really did.
They believed that. And they drew the appropriate consequences of a human being is nothing but an accident of creation. And if there is no supervening moral agency in the cosmos, hey... Why not do what we feel like doing? And in the case of Nazis, what they felt like doing was killing a whole lot of people. And they did.
But, of course, don't you think, of course, they were really sort of an offset of Darwinism and its godless concepts. And they really felt that they were improving the gene pool by doing away with groups that they felt were undesirable.
I think that's right. That's what they said to one another. The fact that they were largely stupid men and that they had many, many scientific concepts inaccurately applied... I think that's beside the point. They looked upon themselves as being heirs to a particular kind of tradition in which, first of all, human beings were regarded as essentially accidents of creation, certainly not protected by any form of divine presence, and second of all, as if they were instruments of a system of Darwinian purification. Bear in mind, it's not necessary to claim that they got Darwin exactly right, that they read Origin of Species and understood it. They didn't. They were kind of dumb. The Nazis will never be counted among the great intellects of the human race. But nonetheless, what is crucial is the way they behaved and the kind of things they said to one another in justification. They always use this language, call it a degenerate form of Darwinism, if you really want to protect the reputation of the master. And I have no objection to that. But nonetheless, excuse me, there is a current of thought that moves from the position that Darwin adopted in 1859, in which a human being is an accident of creation, and the law of biology is one of unceasing conflict between species, to the Nazis' view. But the law of human society is one of unceasing conflict between races. There is that connection. It is foolish to deny it. We don't do any credit to Darwin by saying his ideas are so pure, so virtuous, so sanctimonious, that for some reason they could never possibly be misappropriated. That's not true.
No, and I think the Holocaust certainly is a perfect example of that.
I do, too.
And then, of course, you talk, in fact, you have a very impressive list there. It takes a couple of pages of the genocides that have taken place.
Since
the beginning of the 20th century. And it is shocking and horrifying as you see the fantastic number of people who have been systematically eradicated by governments in the name of expediency.
You know, I wrote that. I included that in the book. Obviously, the statistics are ones I've derived from the literature, but I included that because I came across this incredible claim by Steven Pinker, who is a professor at Harvard, professor of linguistics and psychology at Harvard. And he says, you know, the evidence indicates we're getting better and gooder and kinder and more generous. We don't whip our wives anymore. We don't mistreat animals. My goodness, what a spectacular instrument of progress 20th century secular society has really been. And you look at these kind of claims and you say to yourself, what world is this man living in? What distance from reality does he reside?
And, of course, this is really so true. If there is no God, then there are no moral standards. If there are no moral standards, then you end up just about the way we are today, unfortunately.
Well, the moral standards and force of the... Richard Rorty, my professor at Princeton, was very troubled by this, and he was a sensitive man, and he was certainly not an ignorant man. And he finally came to the conclusion, because he was completely unwilling to countenance any form of theological commitment, that the only basis for moral judgments are more or less what a society makes up as it goes along. And I remember discussions with him. We came to the inevitable point. Well, what argument would you offer against Nazi Germany, against the Holocaust, against genocide? And he was honest enough to say, I have no arguments, except for aesthetic or artistic distaste, a sense of revulsion. But if that's the free expression of one society, if one society says, you know, what we like doing is killing a lot of people, and another society says we don't happen to like killing a lot of people, there is no grounds for rational reproach between the two societies. That's Rorty's position, and he admitted it. He just acknowledged it.
Well, you know, the impression you get from reading what these scientists, these so-called men of letters, and they're brilliant people. I do not tend to degrade their intelligence, except when it comes to this matter of the existence of God or absolute moral standards. And then it almost seems to be like a religious conviction founded not upon scientists, but upon their individual prejudice.
I think part of that's true. I think you have to, when you're talking about the intelligence of these figures, or their level of learning, or their insight, perspicacity, or what have you, I think you have to pick and choose. Some of these guys are very intelligent. You know, we're among friends. We might as well admit it. Some of them are pretty dim bulbs, too. That's just to be expected. The idea that because a guy has a PhD after his name and teaches at Oxford that he's got to be a luminous intellect, we know better. We know better in the year 2008. The academic world is sort of a refuge. It has some interesting flora and fauna, but some pathetic specimens as well.
And, of course, the trouble is, though, if you are in academics, no matter where you are, and you are suddenly coming out and talking about your Christian or Jewish or even your Muslim faith and building upon your life model upon faith, you're going to come under tremendous pressure and discrimination.
Tremendous amount of snootiness, that's for sure. Better not admit those proclivities before you get tenure, I'll tell you that.
Especially, of course, if you believe that in creation and you believe that Darwin was wrong.
No. Just keep quiet about that one. Don't say a word.
But, you know, certainly we've always considered academics as this is where you can express, ideas. You can condemn the administration.
My poor friend, you've had this belief for how long?
Well, I don't believe this, but theoretically this is the way it's supposed to be. We both know that that's not the way it is at all.
What was it that Goethe said? Theory is gray, life is otherwise. You know, I spent 40 years in the academic world. That is the last conclusion I would endorse, that it's a place where freedom and diversity are cherished for themselves. It's not. It's not. It's an incredibly narrow-minded, orthodox, stifling environment. I bless the day I left the academic world.
Well, now, of course, do you still lecture in mathematics or philosophy?
Whenever I get a chance, sure. But mainly I write. I count myself as a writer rather than a lecturer. But of course, that's a matter of opportunity. Remarkably few people seem to want me to lecture anywhere.
Well,
I can't account for that.
How did you happen to find Paris, or go to live in Paris?
I picked it out from the map when I decided I had to get out of the United States for a while. It was just too claustrophobic. For personal reasons, a happy marriage and need to escape. Paris sounded good. My parents had lived in Paris, and I had grown up on stories about Paris, and I had a few friends there.
Do you enjoy Paris today?
Yeah, very much. You know, I have to tell you the truth. I hardly ever leave my apartment. I don't do much. I don't take advantage of the city. I mean, it's a common complaint, you know.
And I've never seen such traffic. I remember being there in the 50s when I was in the military, and then going back, you know, 30 years later, and my goodness, it's almost worth your life.
Oh, try riding a motorcycle in Paris.
We'll be back in just a moment with David Berlinski. Go right ahead, you were saying.
Try riding a motorcycle in Paris traffic.
Oh, well, I guess the one thing that impressed me about Paris, of course, that all the cars seem to have dented fenders as if they were all running into one another like you would, you know.
Yeah, and if you're riding a motorcycle, it's not the car that has the dented fender, it's you.
Well, you don't ride a motorcycle, I hope.
I gave it up after I had a slight accident.
Oh, right.
I'm the only motorcycle rider in history to fall off the bicycle when it wasn't moving.
Oh, right. Well, anyway, of course, our guest this evening is David Berlinski, and of course, his book is The Devil's Delusion. And of course, I happen as an evangelical Christian to believe in the devil. I believe he's a very real force. But why did you, as a secular individual coming from the Jewish perspective, pick that as a title?
Well, it's interesting. You know, everybody says, you were just playing against the title that Richard Dawkins used. What was it? The God Delusion. And to be perfectly honest, my own defense, it never crossed my mind to use that that phrase because Richard Dawkins had used it. I used it for two reasons. One, it's a well-known theological idea that the ultimate refuge of the devil is to persuade people and is in existence. That's one idea. And the second is there's a wonderful quotation from Shakespeare where he says he must have a long spoon that must sup with the devil. So I wanted to put those two things together. And it seemed to work as a title. I think it expresses the theme of the book, the ultimate delusion, the devil's delusion.
Well, I really believe it is the devil's delusion, the old idea, do whatever, do what thou wilt, that's the whole of the law. And of course, that's basically what happens if you do not have any concept that there is a soul, that there is eternity, and that there is punishment for what we do. And, of course, you make that point as well, that certainly, whether it's real or not, the idea that, of course, we live and we die and then we are judged for what we've done is a restraint upon the excesses of activity.
And it's a very uncomfortable idea. One resists it with all one's force because the natural inclination of human beings, corrupt and sinful as they are, is to resist any constraints on their behavior. It's certainly been true in my life. I've resisted it all my life.
Well, of course, as you grow older, do you think there's a possibility that there may be a God?
Yeah, those, you know, 3 a.m. in the morning, you begin to reflect on that. And the first thing you begin to reflect on is, my goodness, maybe it's too late.
Well, I don't think it's ever really too late. I'm 70, I'm 79, because I've been a Christian for many years, but I have no fear at all of death because I know where I'm going. At least I believe I know where I'm going, and it really is a very, very consoling thing, especially when you may be facing going in for a surgical procedure and you wonder something might go wrong, and yet, of course, you say, well, if I die, this is not the end. I know where I'm going to spend eternity.
I comfort myself with the thought that if that should happen at my next surgical procedure, the world will go mad with grief. That gives me consolation.
Well, after reading your book, I'm sure that many people will mourn your passing, but I certainly hope that this not happen to you.
Oh, me too. Me too. Don't get me wrong.
All right. Well, anyway, Chris, as you go through your... You use many standard arguments. Of course, you use the argument about all the excesses of religion. And of course, that's one of the things that's used against Christianity. Well, what about the Inquisition? What about the Crusades? I mean, how can you possibly defend Torquemada? And of course, that immediately puts the Christians into a terribly defensive position.
I don't defend the Inquisition. I mean, curiously enough, just several months ago, I was at the Vatican of all places. Please don't ask what I was doing. I found myself at the office of the Inquisition, which still exists in the Vatican.
You hold that thought for just a moment as we bring our stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest is David Berlinski. We're talking about his book, The Devil's Delusion. Fascinating reading, especially when we consider the theological background of the gentleman we're talking to, and yet I tend to agree with just about everything he's written. And he was just saying, of course, that we were talking about the fact that the The people who hate Christianity will always use the Inquisition, the Catholic Inquisition in Torquemada. They'll talk about the Crusades. I don't think you mentioned the Crusades, but that's the other thing that they always do. And pointing out to the violence and the injustice of these two things. And then David was just saying that, well, of course, it wasn't too long ago. He was actually at the Vatican, and you were there. Do you want to tell us what you were doing there?
For the life of me, I wish I could. I don't know. Somehow or other, it worked out that someone asked me to speak to the office of the Inquisition. And I actually had lunch with the two senior papal inquisitors. And the office still exists. Two nicer guys you couldn't possibly imagine. And we discussed all these issues. It's clear that I had no standing to discuss it. I'm not, in any sense, integral to the Catholic faith. But they were very honest. We had a very frank, interesting discussion.
Well,
of course,
sure.
My position was that they should stop apologizing for Galileo, for heaven's sakes. They were right, after all. He was a remarkable pest in his dealing with the Inquisition. But the basic point they made, and I think they made a completely correct point, is, look, there's a big difference between violating or not living up to the standards of, say, the Christian faith as expressed in Catholic doctrine, and having no standards whatsoever. That is the real distinction, the disjunction in thought. Yes, the Church did commit excesses, but it committed excesses in the name of a very lofty spiritual standard, which it abused. But let's not confuse the existence of the standard and the violations of the standard. Those are two different things. This is particularly galling when you reflect on someone like Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris or any of these people.
And, of course, these people are just so violently anti-Christian, anti-religious.
It's such a false violence. It's such an act of self-deception. You know, when a Christopher Hitchens gets up in the morning and he goes to shave and he sees his beaming face in the mirror and he says to himself, you know, that's a pretty nice face, and the world would be a pretty nice place if people were pretty much like me and we could live in a spirit of enlightenment, tolerance, feelings of goodwill toward one another, abundant sexual pleasures, enjoy the moment while we can. And not even for a second does he realize that he is not the author of that face. He's the beneficiary of a 2,000-year-old Christian tradition that's given him his face. And he simply doesn't recognize it. All the things he holds as virtues, the spirit of equanimity, the spirit of good-naturedness, the spirit of indulgence, the spirit of tolerance, the spirit of fairness, he didn't create that for himself. If that face and the body that goes with it were removed to pagan Rome or antique Greece, it would find the world a remarkably strange, different, brutal place. It would be horrified by what it sees. Something did happen in the experience of the human race with the introduction in the West of the Christian faith. It's unmistakable. I'm saying this as a Jew. It's simply the truth. And when these guys look in the mirror and draw trite and trivial conclusions from what they see without ever recognizing the historical continuity that has shaped their view of the world, one can only talk in terms of self-deception.
Very well said. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Do you don't mind taking calls, do you?
Me? No, I love them.
All right, fine. Again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And our guest is David Berlinski. We're talking about his book, The Devil's Delusion. And, of course, coming from the point of view of a secular Jew, really, we have to recognize the fact that whatever your religious faith is, the world is a better place because there are moral standards and there are people who believe in God, and it's changed the world. And of course,
how could you deny it?
Well, I couldn't deny it.
I'm asking. I know you would. I know. I didn't mean to insinuate that. I wasn't suggesting you were adopting an antagonistic position. But I'm saying rhetorically, it seems to me, in my partiality and ignorance, that is an overwhelmingly plausible point.
And, of course, it's really what makes life worthwhile. In fact, if in my way of thinking, if there is no God, then life is really sort of a futile. And, you know, the old adage that life is tough and then you die, or, you know.
That's kind of a bleak panorama, isn't it?
It sure is. Well, you know, but, of course, being involved in what I believe is the great spiritual battle that is being fought out today. Life is exciting every day. We get up in the morning to do our 7 o'clock in the morning program, and at least we have an opportunity of being heard by a few thousand people, and hopefully it's having an impact in their thinking. Well, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295, and when we get back, we'll let David tell you how to get hold of a copy of his book, The Devil's Delusion, Atheism and Its Scientific Pretenses. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Berlinski, and Chris, he's written a fascinating book challenging the leading scientists of our day, or some of the leading scientists of our day, who've come out openly and, of course, attacking Christianity, attacking a belief in God. And, of course, they can do that. They write their books, and there's nobody there to challenge them. You write a book, why, Chris, then that's, that comes out as a definite statement of fact. And then, of course, along comes David Berlinski, certainly with excellent academic credentials, having taught philosophy and having taught mathematics, and certainly coming from the intellectual point of view. And then he simply challenges these leaders of the scientific community as to the and points out the fallacies of their arguments. Are you having any counters? Are you having any opposition to your views?
I think it's a little early. Don't forget the book really was published April 1st.
No, I didn't realize it, of course, it was that recent then.
And it hasn't really gotten into the bookstores yet. It's available on Amazon. They're great. I mean, they've got a huge stock of the books. But the bookstores haven't really gotten their shipments yet, so I suspect it's a little early. On the other hand, it's entirely possible that my views will be ignored forever. Entirely possible.
Well, because that's really one of the best ways, of course, to neutralize a view that you oppose.
Yeah, but I'm counting on their wounded pride. I'm really banking on that.
Yeah, you know, but you're hoping that you can open the dialogue.
Oh, yeah, sure, of course I am.
Well, I certainly hope that you can as well, because, of course, you present your positions very well. And of course,
thank you.
And their positions are really very indefensible. In fact, they're really based upon a faith.
What's interesting? They're very fragile. You know, you handle them for a few minutes, they just crumble like so many cakes of soap that have been exposed to the sun.
And, of course, the arguments are just so straightforward. I mean, how can you possibly use science to disprove the existence of God? And yet that's the statement they make, and yet you can't disprove anything. It's hard enough to prove things, but even harder to disprove them.
What's interesting is that when you actually look at what, say, a Richard Dawkins says, Chapter 4 of The God Delusion. He introduces an argument, and he smacks his forehead and says to himself and to his readers, of course, my God, is this ingenious. Nobody's ever thought of this one before. You go back 8 centuries and you read Aquinas, the Summa Theologica, there it is, in its full complexity, set out with magnificent lucidity in medieval Latin. Aquinas examines the argument, he holds it up, he smacks it on its bottom, he turns it upside down, and then he dismisses it, because it's a puerile argument. And he goes on to state the correct conclusion to be drawn from premises that Richard Dawkins has introduced. Dawkins has an infinite regress argument. If you believe God created the universe, then who created God? Well, there are two things wrong with the argument, even if you can't answer
hold
the
that, universe. Hold that thought for just a moment.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, David Berlinski, and we're talking about his book, The Devil's Delusion, which incidentally has only come out just a couple of weeks ago, and so we're fortunate to get an early copy of the book, and of course to have Mr. Berlinski on before he goes back over to Paris, where he's currently living and writing, and of course having taught for 40 years in academics, he certainly has the prestige to challenge many of the scientists who are using, in the name of science, an effort to destroy a belief in God. Whereas, of course, there's no way they can do that. Please, you were making a point, and I interrupted you.
You know, late at night, was I making an important point?
I'm not sure where we were going to go with that, but that's all right.
I was talking about Richard Dawkins. I remember that, and I was arguing that, I remember that Aquinas, for example, anticipates every one of his arguments and rejects them. It is only somebody who is flamboyantly and willfully ignorant of the tradition he's addressing that could possibly write these sort of things in the year 2008. That seems to me astonishing, and also the fact that he hasn't been called on that seems to me very reproachful with respect to the academic world. You know, there are plenty of scholars who know better, plenty of scholars.
Well, of course, but most of them do not want to come out in defense
not
of
one.
Christianity. We have to, of course, what we need, of course, is Christian theologians. But then, of course, you have the advantage of nobody who's ever going to accuse you of prejudice. You're simply looking at it from the philosophical point of view and from the point of view of are the arguments valid and the arguments really are not valid.
They're no good. They're just no good.
Well, do you have a website out there where you discuss any of these things?
I really should, right?
You should.
It's embarrassing, this sort of question. You know, the I'll give you the truth, if that's permissible.
Yeah, of course it is. But
I am so technically incompetent that I couldn't begin to set up my own website. And my children only laugh at me when I suggest it.
Well, unfortunately, my son puts up our website and does an excellent job.
Yeah, my kids put up a website for themselves.
I see.
And I'm locked out of it. I can't access that one.
All right,
I'll just have to live with my limitations. Me and the computer, we don't get along. So
all right, fine. Well, anyway, Chris, the book, The Devil's Delusions, available from Amazon.com. That's all you need to know. It may be on Barnes & Noble's. And
I think Barnes & Noble's got it, too, on their website, whatever it is.
Under any circumstances, it's a book that's well worthwhile reading because we have to be able to, of course, to address these arguments. And, of course, as a Christian and certainly a person who gets into these arguments, these discussions all the time on the radio, it's important that we have a means of knowing how to address it. The other side...
Well, I agree. I agree completely.
...has all of these very, very convincing arguments. And if you haven't thought them through ahead of time, and you're on the radio and there are 10,000 people or 20,000 people listening, and you don't have the answer, you're in real trouble. So
I know. You know, some of the arguments are so childish and yet so effective that it's embarrassing to recount them. You get a Sam Harris coming on a radio show saying to you, for example, well, do you believe in Zeus? What are you going to say? Well, no, I don't happen to worship Zeus. And the counter is, well, why believe in God? And it takes a moment before you realize the evident nonsensical quality of that kind of asseveration. If you don't believe in Zeus, belief in God is irrational.
Well, of course, the thing is that in the course of a discussion, especially in a debate situation, why, of course, you've got to be very quick on your feet. I can see that you are, even at this late time of
night. It's amazing to me that I'm able to keep functioning.
Well, I'm glad you can, because otherwise I'd be doing an hour's monologue here. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24.
I'm just warming up my tonsils now, ready to go to the next hour.
Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're listening out there across America, you have a question or comment for Dr. David Berlinski, why we'd love to hear from you, because I think that it's so important that you know how to defend the faith against these very, very superficial arguments. And, of course, how do you defend against the charges of the Inquisition? How do you defend against the charges of certainly the hypocrisy that we've seen many, many times within the Catholic Church or within the Protestant Church? And, of course, we have to have a framework to be able to do what you have to do best, and that is to put the opposition into a defensive position. What they want to do, and I've learned this through the debate, is put you into a defensive position.
Of course.
What you have to do is turn it around and put them into a defensive position. Well, I really hope that you have the opportunity, of course, to get some of these people into an open debate, either on radio or on television, or even sometimes certainly a debate on the Internet in a series of essays, point and counterpoint.
I would be delighted. I'm looking forward to doing all those things. I hope that I'll have the opportunity to do it. But, you know, it's as you remarked very perceptively, to ignore a critical position is perhaps the easiest way to defend an indefensible position.
Amen to that. Well, we've got a couple of callers on the line, but they haven't told me who they are, calling from across America. People, a lot of our listeners, of course, on the East Coast this time of evening, and it's getting late for them as well, but we appreciate their being there. Well, certainly as we go through your the whole thing, of course, you deal a great deal with the Holocaust, and just the insanity of this whole tragedy as it unfolds, and the tremendous impact it's had on the lives of so many tragic people, and of course the fact that today there are people who actually still deny that the Holocaust ever took place is beyond my concepts, because I've had an opportunity to talk to some of the people who were at Auschwitz and did survive.
And that yet, was of course, the final prediction of the SS. I don't know whether you know this. That in the last days of the war, when the SS communicated one to another, when they realized that they were going to be not only defeated, but they were facing themselves physical destruction because of the Soviets were pledged to eliminate anyone who wore an SS uniform, they claimed for themselves a particular privilege, and the only word to describe it is diabolical. They said they had committed the worst crimes in human history and that no one would believe it.
I thought that was just such a very valid point when you put it forward. Let's go to Richard, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Richard. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes. The question is about the author of a book you mentioned, I think sort of refuting the existence of God. And I thought you, I wasn't sure whether you said Richard Dawkins or Richard...
Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins.
Richard Dawkins, yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Okay, that was my question. I think I'm sort of familiar with that book, and well, I just wanted to clear up that point.
All right, anything else?
Very interesting. Thank you.
All right, fine. Let's go to John, who's calling from.
Hello.
Hi,
hello?
John. Where are you from in New York? What's that city?
Oneonta.
Oh, that's the reason I didn't recognize it. Okay, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I got a comment.
Okay, go ahead.
And a question sort of wrapped up in one. Our culture has been predominantly a Christian culture, and we have been overly confident in our beliefs at the expense of other cultures. Yet we have no proof of what our belief is based on. It's a faith.
Are you talking about the United States right now?
Or Western culture?
Hello?
But I think, go over, ask your question again, please, Rich, David.
My question is that our culture, our Western culture, is based on the Judeo-Christian faith.
Right.
Yes.
And we have been overly confident in the past centuries as our way is the only way, it's the truth. Yet we have done this at the expense of many cultures, and we have ignored knowledge that these cultures could have given us over time.
I think to a certain extent that is true, but I also suggest that in the early part of the 21st century, it is a mistake to talk about overconfidence in the West. In fact, I think quite the reverse is true. It's a terrible crisis of confidence, because having been forced to admit perhaps that we have failed to learn as much as we could possibly learn from other cultures, we have come increasingly to doubt what we should not doubt at all, is that we live in a culture of extraordinary ingenuity and intellectual fertileness that has made possible a remarkable society. That shouldn't be placed so stringently in doubt, I think. I think that's a mistake. By all means, let's admit that we can look at the historical record and say some things are appalling in Western culture, some things are outrageous, some things should never have taken place. But to suggest that we suffer in 2008 a real crisis of overconfidence, I think, is a mistake. What is really manifest in the United States and certainly in Western Europe is a tremendous crisis of the spirit, a seeming inability to confront the obstacles in front of us, to deal manfully with what we need to deal with.
And I would point out, John, that I'm 79. I live in an entirely different world today than the one that I lived in for the first 20 years of my life. America was a far different nation at that time, an entirely different set of values, and we've progressively eroding the Judeo-Christian the character of our nation, and also there have been some wicked, wicked people in positions of power who've done some terrible things in the name of America, whether it be the Spanish-American War or the Philippine-American War, which most Americans have never even heard of, where, of course, we slaughtered several hundred thousand Filipinos, bringing them freedom. Did you want to comment on that, David?
I said up to a million were killed.
Right, right. In your book, you said 220,000, but of course the figure is certainly well up to a million. Most Americans never even heard of the Filipino-American War. So, John, what we need to do is cling to the good, recognize the bad, and certainly be willing, of course, to be critical where criticism is justified. Anything else you'd like to say?
Yes. What I would really like to press on is that we have minimized what other people can contribute to our society for the sake of pressing on the word.
Because we have, on
a lot of occasions, made our belief to be like the crux, the cornerstone, what is fundamental. And we fail to emphasize that it's simply a faith, such as Islam, Buddhism, and all these things, that they're simply faith. And to attribute our success of the culture for the technology and whatever kind of diminishes the fact that we are emphasizing a faith, and we should not give other people the impression that our faith is dogma.
All right, fine. John, really, which one of these other countries would you like to live in?
What other country would I?
Well, I mean, would you like to live in a Shinto country? Would you like to live in a Buddhist country? Would you like to live in a Hindu country?
I've lived in a lot of countries. I've lived in Italy. I've lived in France.
But these are all part of Western civilization, Christian civilization.
Tanzania is not a Christian country.
What's that?
Tanzania is an African country.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. No, wasn't thinking of that. I was thinking of where you were talking about Italy and European countries. Anyway,
yes.
Thank you so very much for calling. Appreciate your thoughts. And our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question or comment for our guest this evening, David Berlinski, we'd love to hear from you. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. And we're basically talking about how do you defend our civilization, Western civilization, a Judeo-Christian civilization, because, of course, Christianity came out of the cradle of Judaism, and the two of them, of course, are intricately melded, even though we may have different views on some things, that we have a common belief in many of the fundamentals of society that have transformed the lives of women, have transformed society, had made for a very humane society, in contrast to so many of the other societies that exist throughout the world today. So, suddenly, you have a section in here on the Muslim faith. Would you like to elaborate a little on that?
Well, I'm of two minds. I think one should always begin by saying there is something that did come over the United States and certainly in Europe after September 11th, some penetrating vision of the evil that's possible in the name of a radical theological movement. Anyone who is blind to that is not living in the early part of the 21st century. And I think some motivation for the new atheism can be tracked directly back to September 11th, this feeling of horror. What is possible? What is really possible? And what could be possible if, for example, nuclear weapons fell into the wrong hands? But that having been said, I'm also appalled at the extent to which intellectuals, academics, scientists, certainly the guys who are contributing to the new atheist movement, in the first place know absolutely nothing about the Muslim tradition. That is, have not studied its text any serious way, do not understand the nature of the creedal commitment they express, have no understanding of the life that is lived, and consequently have no appreciation of the fact that there are at least a billion people out there, that's many, many people, a billion people out there who look with a certain concern at the nature of a secular society and find it within their hearts possible to reject some aspects of a secular society. There's a great unwillingness to confront this for what it really is, a kind of judgment rendered upon us, yeah, us of all people, by a billion other people who find themselves very, very much at odds with the nature and inclination of a purely secular society. That's something we need to come to grips with in a much better way. The discussion has to be more inclusive. I'm agreeing with your last caller to some extent. It has to be more penetrating. It certainly has to be more sympathetic. Because when you have a situation in which a billion people say, you know, we admire, we appreciate the glory of Western culture, certainly its technology, because we embrace it every chance we have. And we don't wish to live lives of desperate poverty, but deep down there is something that we find deeply off-putting about secular societies. That's something we should acknowledge.
Well, of course, you know, as I see what's happening today as far as relationship with the Muslim nations, I'm sure you're well acquainted with Samuel Huntington's book,
sure,
The Class of Civilizations. And he warned us against, you know, trying to impose our beliefs on the Muslim world. He said this is just going to be a quagmire, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Unfortunately, I think that's right. But, you know, that very often becomes a question of political strategy, what to do when faced with the exigencies of a particular political situation, about which I cannot speak because I know nothing about it. But beyond that, I think there's the important element of judgment. And the talk of the Islamic faith is to talk about one of the three great world religions in many respects, a religion with immense appeal. We can spend hours discussing why it should have this appeal, but the fact that it does have this appeal, that it answers to certain human needs in a very powerful way, seems to me undeniable, and a fact too easily overlooked.
And of course, you know, I think that the standards of morality, we may disagree with some of the forms of punishments in the Muslim faith.
Oh, I do. I do, of course.
Women, but I mean, here's a faith that stresses charity, prayer, and certainly integrity, and most Muslims, you know, are really very nice people.
Of course, that should go without saying, but it doesn't.
And it doesn't either because we don't understand the Muslim faith, and we tend to equate it with jihad and what happened on September 11th. Well, hang on just a moment here, and we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program here at Radio Liberty. Well, we have actually 3 minutes to wrap up the program. So what are the parting thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners out across America?
I don't know that I have any particular pearls of wisdom to offer. I think this has been an immensely instructive kind of discussion. You know, I've had it again and again and again on the radio. I'm always astonished that when you push away the debris of polemics and the irritability and anger that the discussion provokes, it's just amazing to me what a deep hunger there is for clarity and clarification and a certain measured degree of wisdom on these issues. You know, everyone, even those most vigorous in their denunciation of religion, everyone is in roughly the same position. We're all groping. We're all uncertain. We're all, to a certain extent, confused. We all wish that there would be more light, and we're searching for the light. Every last one of the people I've interacted with basically has the same attitude, the same opinion. They're confused about the way those opinions and attitudes could best be expressed, but, you know, so am I. There's no harm in saying that. What we need to do is reject the fearful dogmatism of any position on the compass. The fearful dogmatism of the scientific elite happens to be my particular target. I'm sure there are other dogmatisms to combat. And just appreciate the imponderable nature of these questions and how important they really are and how we could not successfully live as human beings without them.
And, of course, I think we can all agree that we need some sort of a concept of something greater than ourselves, other we would be answerable to or whatever that...
Otherwise we perish.
Right. And if there is no God, why, of course, to me, life has very little, if any, meaning. Well, you know, I think it's fascinating, Chris. I know that you've been very, very busy because we've been trying to get you onto our program, you know, for the weeks that you've been here. And every time we have you lined up for a program, why, you have an opportunity to go on some larger program. And so,
that's not true. I reject that. I've always been eager to be on your program. I've always placed that number one in my list of priorities. You know, I don't choose these things. The person who's handling public relations arranges my entire life for me when I get up, when when I go to sleep, where I go to lunch, everything.
Well, of course, they have done a very, very good job at protecting you, and they were very nice about, of course, getting you on this evening, for which I was very, very grateful. And
me too.
They have people that, of course, at Spence Publishing that got you on, do an excellent job of promoting books. I don't think they published your book, did they?
No, it's Crown Farm that published it.
All right, fine. Well, they do this public relations for a number of other publishers as well as their own books. Anyway, I want to thank you so very much. It's been a fascinating hour, and I wish you well, and I'm looking forward to your next book.
Thanks very, very much for having me on.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
All right, fine. Well, that was David Berlinski. Of course, his book is The Devil's Delusion. Fascinating. It's a very readable book that will help you to really be able to argue for the Christian faith. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I do hope you've enjoyed our conversation with David Berlinski, who approaches really the discussion of the defense of Western civilization and Christian civilization based upon the fact that he is a secular Jew, but he objects to the arguments that are being used by the so-called scientists, using science to prove there is no God, where, of course, they really can't do that. And he recognizes that, really, of course, whether God is real or not, man has to believe in him. Man has to have a belief in something greater than himself. I'm often reminded of that wonderful movie Ulysses, of course, where, of course, the hero stands on the beach after having been kept away from his family for many years following the Battle of Troy. And he cries out on the beach to the waves, "Why are you doing this? Why are you keeping away from home?" And, of course, this voice comes from the depths. And it says, "Because man cannot live without his gods." And even though, of course, this is, purely fictional, I believe it's very, very true. We do need a God. Now, I believe that Christian faith is the true faith. I believe, of course, unfortunately, it is not practiced as it should be. And I believe there is tremendous corruption within the structure of organized religion. But that does not in any way detract from the beauty of the Bible, God's holy word. And it is the answer to all of man's needs, if properly applied. Well, our telephone number, of course, is 1-800-544-8927. If you'd, of course, like to, of course, get some of the material we put out, because, of course, we point out that there is an organized effort to destroy Christianity, and this is really through the occult organizations. There really are millions of people who worship a different God. And, of course, if you'd get our talk on the forbidden secret, and, of course, the syllabus goes with that. Our talk on the planned police state not only talks about the fact that we are moving towards a police state, but why. And, of course, what are these forces behind the scenes? And we actually provide you with some of their material. Again, the telephone number, the title is The Planned Police State. And there's an excellent syllabus for that, which will give you the documentation that you need, of course, to be able to convince others that there really is a plan in case of a national emergency, which can be contrived at any time, to suspend the Constitution and the right of habeas corpus and begin rounding up American citizens and put them into concentration camps. And we do hope that many of you out there will get our material. And we have a four-tape set on concentration camps. We have a DVD. It's entitled America, Behind Barbed Wire, put together by our good friend David Wagner. We have, of course, some of the documents going into the background. We actually have something called Amazing Clips, but there you'll see the Iran-Contra hearings, where, of course, they tried to bring out that there was this plan, and of course, the Congressman Jack Brooks was silenced by Senator Inouye, who did not want the American people to know about this plan, that everything is in place for the establishment of a dictatorship. And people say it just can't happen here in America. And I would simply reply, why not? If God is just, he's going to bring judgment on this country in a terrible, terrible way. So let me suggest again the talk on the forbidden secret, very important. My book, Brotherhood of Darkness, very important. And, of course, you can get the DVD of that if you want to. The DVD on the planned police state and the syllabus goes with that. And then, of course, we hope many of you will want to get the videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3-hour, 4-hour, 10-hour version, because it introduces you to the demonic element that is at work within our society today. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will want to get the excellent DVDs, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, and then the second of the series, Riddles in Stone. I have a small part in both of those. What I have to say is not that important. It's the overall theme, that there have always been two forces at work in America. One, a strong Christian group, a movement, dedication, and then, of course, the demonic organizations, which are not imaginary, but are really very, very real, intent upon destroying our nation. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.